Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week, our attention turns to the world's favoured currency hedge, gold. Over the last 2 years, the price of the yellow metal has been on a remarkable tear, enthralling the gold bugs and creating some big opportunities for well-run gold producers to literally mine money. With gold reaching record highs in July, the question now remains, what key drivers are essential for the strength to continue? And as COVID-related stimulus pumps more freshly printed currency into the global money supply, will scarcity prevail? Joining us to ask the question, is gold the anti-dollar? We have John Dinez, who is the Chief Investment Officer of boutique fund manager Paragon. John co-founded Paragon in 2012 and is responsible for executing the investment strategy and managing the Paragon Australian Long Short Fund. He has over 20 years of relevant industry experience, including 16 years in financial markets. John Dinez, welcome back to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me back on.
Good to have you on again. Also joining us today to discuss how these themes play out in our portfolios, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And also on the line, we have our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello, David.
G'day, Tim, and everybody.
Wonderful. And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the chat box at nucleuswealth.com/webinar. So let's jump into it. Our first slide for today, we're looking at the inflation break-even. So I'll hand over to you, gentlemen.
Yeah, I might actually. We've got some few slides up on that we'll show up as time goes on, but we're probably going to do a bit more of a discussion around some of the issues around gold. So I think for anyone who didn't tune in last time, we spoke to John. John runs a long short fund. He'll give you a little bit more detail as we go through this, but. The discussion sort of ended up mostly around gold and what the opportunities John saw within that sector a few months ago. And so given that the gold price has run up quite substantially, we thought it was well worth to get John back on and just to discuss what the major issues are going forward. And John has written a piece not that long ago, sort of a month or so ago, and just sort of we thought we'd base a bit of the conversation around that, and then sort of jump more into some of the what he's seeing in some of the other stocks again after that. So maybe we might kick off and start with John. You sort of got six drivers, I think you had in your recent post. Just sort of if you want to maybe give a bit of a summary of that, and then we'll get stuck into it.
Sure, Damien, thanks. So. We've touched on these drivers in the last call we did together, and we've been pretty vocal on them for maybe the last 2 years. But what's really played out anyway in the last 5 months since our last call, some of these key drivers have just gone from strength to strength for driving gold higher. And firstly, bond rates. Bond rates have basically collapsed. It's hard to believe. Around 2 years ago, they were, up over 3%. This is US 10-year bond rates, and they're now, post COVID, they fell to 0.6%. They've been in a range for the last couple of months, somewhere between 0.6 and 0.8%. Today, they're around 0.7%. So very low long-term bond rates in the US. Real rates. The bigger driver for gold, they've collapsed. They've gone from plus 1% again around 2 years ago to today they're trading at minus 1%. And real rates, they're driven by two things, of course, the nominal 10-year bond rate, as well as inflation expectations, which have recovered fairly quickly since the March COVID crash. And so for those that aren't that familiar, real rates, they're a huge drive for gold, and they let's not forget they fell to minus 6% in the 70s and in that amazing gold run. Beyond those two, of course, other drivers is the amount of money printing, money supply, US fiscal, US deficits, and they've all been going, they've all been blowing out debt levels. But if I start with, I suppose, the first key one, US deficits just last month were, hit US $3 trillion, and that's now 15% of their GDP. And we haven't got to those levels since the 40s, where there were 3 years in a row of greater than 20% US deficits. And so that with, M2 money supply basically going vertical, growing at 20% year on year, again, rivaling almost the growth you saw in the 40s through the war period. Collectively, they're all huge catalysts for gold.
I obviously I agree with John's summation. I think it's very bullish for gold. You didn't mention the US dollar though, there, John.
No, that of course is the last man standing, as we've been calling it for a while. And thanks for highlighting it. The US dollar has, unlike bond rates and real rates, which have been in decline for, like I said, considerable decline the last 2 years, the US dollar really rolled over only recently. It's only the last, call it 3 months, where it's pretty much soon after the COVID market crash, where the US dollar basically topped out and has since fallen around 10%. And to us, it looks like it's going lower. And reason being, you only have to look at what happens to the US dollar index when you get deficits blowing out the way they have, and we expect them to continue. Typically there's a negative correlation there, and as US dollar comes off, gold and all commodities tend to do well. Of course, they're denominated in the US dollar, and 2/3 of global trades in USD. And what was striking about gold early on was gold was doing well despite the US dollar rising. But now that the last man standing has given way and has started to roll over, that's yet again another tailwind for the move we see, the ongoing move we see coming in gold.
Yeah. Devin, what do you see? Maybe give us a sense of sort of short, medium, and long for the US dollar and gold.
Sure. Look, I'll start with US dollars. Obviously, a hard one to call. It's so many drivers, but and so short term, it's anyone's guess. In fact, I'd say if anything, there might be risk of a slight bounce in the US dollar, just given positioning is so one way at the moment. This is now, lots of people are seeing this, of course. We're all aware of these big factors that we've just discussed. And so with, net short positions, positioning in the US the way it is, I think that explains the slight bounce that it's had. But beyond, I can look beyond the very near term, medium term anyway, I think, I won't be surprised at all to see the US dollar at 85 cents and the US dollar index, that is. And when it...
What's it at today? It's about 90...
It's around 93. It's fell to about low 92s, only in the last few weeks, and it bounced up to about 93.6, I think. But it's in this range and forming a handle at around 93, and our view is the risk is to the downside. And you only have to superimpose how the US dollar index has performed against the US federal deficit historically. And if you've seen those charts, basically very correlated that when you get deficits blowing out to the tune they have to date, you tend to see the US dollar index come under pressure. And then gold, where do we think gold's going? Well, given, the drivers we've talked about, helicopter money, QE to infinity, the firepower that the Fed has, whether we get another fiscal stimulus package or not, we just think the weight of drivers is going to continue driving gold higher, and And again, if you look at historical precedents, we've talked about this before, but whenever you've had negative rates, negative real rates, if you look at the previous 12 gold bull markets in history, the biggest moves have come in rate cycles. And so, you know, gold's up a little bit over 70% in the last 2 years, but we think it's early days in this gold move.
Mm. Yeah, DXY after the GFC, when we had, you know, similar circumstances that you're describing with the big deficits and tumbling bond yields, et cetera, I think it got down to about 72. Is that roughly right? So, I mean, your 85 is still very high relative to where the US dollar index has been in recent history.
That's a fair comment, David, and I won't be at all surprised to see it go lower. I suppose I'm trying to have some conservatism and not sound completely outlandish, but yes, it could go lower.
Yeah, I mean, there are reasons to think it might not go quite as low as well. Just the fact that the alternative currencies have got so many problems these days that it's possible that might provide some support to DXY and almost by default. But basically, I think your thesis is exactly spot on. And one of the things that has intrigued me over time with gold and DXY and some of the other drivers you've talked about is, for the most part, when a gold bull market gets going, it tends to dislocate from, you know, a strict kind of index relationship to any of them. And it's almost like, I mean, the basic thesis I ended up with a few years ago was that all of these drivers are kind of make up the foundation of the US dollar's value, relative value. And, you know, the end result of gold is kind of a bit like greater than the sum of the parts. So what you're really looking at there, you might almost describe this as the sentiment component that's overlaid with it. And so the degree of instability in the fundamentals of the US dollar is really the key driver of the gold price. And when you have really material instability, then it can seriously overshoot any one of them. What do you think of that kind of notion?
Indeed, you only have to look at history of how leading currencies have performed over history. Whether you look at the Dutch cycle, the pound, and now US dollar, they're all they've all come under pressure over long periods of time, and yes, the way the USD plays out will drive just the magnitude of the type of move in gold. But talking about disorderly moves, you've got to be careful what you wish for. It is still, the US dollar still is, you know, what, 2/3, almost 70% of global trade, and so it'll. I'm not saying it can't happen, but I think it's, for now anyway, it's somewhat down. In terms of timing, it's a little dated for me. And I'm really just trying to focus on what I see over the next year or two.
Yeah.
I guess the question, guys, is, sorry, the question for me is saying, in a way, what the basis behind this is that, you know, everyone needs, all these governments need to get out and spend money. And even if, you know, for the people who don't believe in that as a theory, that they're going to get out and spend money and rack up more debts. And I guess the core underlying is that the US is probably going to do more of it than any other country because their central bank's probably one of the more progressive ones out there and seems to be more likely to actually do that. However, that is sort of it's a little bit reliant upon the government to actually print and spend that money as well. So is there anything, I guess, John, in terms of whether there's, you know, does it depend who's in the White House for you? If you had, if you sort of got, let's say you end up with a Biden presidency, but they didn't get the Senate. Is that going to concern you in that they might not be able to spend the money that, that they want to spend?
Definitely, Damien. Given whilst global debt has exploded, the focus or the lead party to this thematic is the US. And yes, if Biden comes in and whether he raises taxes or looks at less expenditure, then I suppose.
What I mean by that, I should have actually expanded on that. My theory is that there's already a few Republicans who are talking about saying, oh, maybe we shouldn't be spending as much money. I think if there was a Democratic president, a lot of them would revert back to all of a sudden saying, no. You know, we're happy to bring the economy down or reduce the growth rate in the economy, given there's a Democratic president. Whereas they're more likely to spend money if there's a Republican president. If you know what I mean.
Indeed, Damon. That, depending on which scenario plays out, will be supportive for gold. So that's one of the big near-term risks for us, the outcome of the election.
Can I talk your book up for you here, John? I actually don't think that matters much. I mean, if you did end up with a relatively austere fiscal setting after the election, then the pressure on the Federal Reserve is going to be immense. You know, you'll have a deflationary environment instead of an inflationary one, and the Fed will have to go gangbusters, even more.
This is
the one of the interesting things about gold. It's most often sold as an inflationary metal, but it does even better in deflationary environments, as far as I can see.
Yeah, we discussed this last time. Gold does well in inflation, deflation, market chaos. But if you do get a change of government, whilst I could sit here all day and argue that there are enough drivers in place to keep the bull market intact, back to your earlier question, which I may not have answered fully, was it's near-term sentiment will play a big part. And if there's a lot of uncertainty as to, if we suddenly go from, spending as much as we can to change of government and question marks on the near-term drivers for gold, it'll cause volatility just as it did. And we know that gold can be very volatile. Just look at what happened through COVID or even through the GFC. I mean, yes, the bull market ran from, some might say it ran from 2001 through to 2011, but let's not forget it corrected 33% through the GFC, despite all the pro-gold measures that were announced. And so, we've got a fair weighting to gold. And so I'm very focused on near-term sentiment changing and causing a potential circa 10 to 15% correction in the commodity.
How do you manage
that? How do I manage it? Well, we're liquid. We're 84% of our portfolio saleable inside 10 days. And so, right now I don't have any gold shorts on, but we are across the cap spectrum, small, mid and large. And so it's the small cap stocks. If you suddenly had a central bank selling or change of government and a set of drivers that we thought would cause, a 15 to 20% correction in the gold price, well, if all bets are off, you'll see us flip and reposition the portfolio. And we can do that a couple of ways. We can sell the liquid names and those that might take a bit longer if we indeed wanted to sell. We could hedge out some names by pairing off some of the long exposures with mid and large cap gold names. And we've done that on occasion over our 8-year history or the 12 years I've been managing money. We're prepared for volatility. If you look at the GFC gold bull market, which ran from November 2008 to September 11, whilst the gold price tripled, there were 10 greater than 5% gold price corrections, and they were anywhere from 5 to 15%, and obviously they caused short-term volatility in the equities. And so we're just trying to stay across the thematic, the drivers, and making that call if we need to.
And what do you how does the Australian dollar factor into your calculus? I mean, I guess as much as, you know, the local gold price, but also in terms of miner costs, etc.
It's a great question. In the last bouts of US dollar gold volatility, typically you've seen the Aussie dollar come off with it, and so the Australian dollar gold price has actually held up quite well. In fact, it's gone even higher. It hit record highs well before the US dollar did. However, it doesn't stop volatility in the Australian gold equities because, in our view, a lot of the buying, particularly of late, it's fairly obvious, is on the margin by North American institutions, and they are, and the moves in the Aussie dollar gold equities, it's not that surprising that it's correlated to the move in the US dollar gold price. And we touched on this last time, reasons, you know, whether it's because of FX translation, or just the fact that they're driven by the US dollar gold move. And that's despite, like I said, Aussie dollar gold price being high and sometimes expanding margins on growing production or cost savings with if the oil price went down with it, labor rates. So it is important on a more medium term view, but short term it's really the US dollar gold price that drives the volatility in the equities.
Just on that, gents, we've had a couple of questions come in just while we're chatting. Where do you think the USD direction will go on election results? Do you think Trump and Biden have different outcomes for the currency? And it's a good leading question for next week's topic as well.
I think if Trump wins, it's more of the same. Biden, I think there'll definitely be volatility, and I'd expect to see the US bounce near term. Beyond that, we'll just have to see the type of measures that will come with Biden.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for that. Any remarks from the other gentlemen in the room? We'll save it for next week.
I'll let Dave have a go first.
See there. Sorry, I've just been muting and yelling at the kids. What am I talking about?
Sorry, the direction of the USD on the US elections, so Trump and Biden, possibly.
I caught the beginning of John's stuff. Yes, I think with Trump, it's steady as she goes and DXY falls, but probably not as much. My basic thesis for that is Trump will persist with tariffs, which are very US dollar bullish. Whereas Biden is anti-tariffs as a geopolitical tool. I'm not saying he would unwind the China trade deal, but he wouldn't use tariffs. Plus, he's more multilateral. And so some of the geopolitical tensions will come out, which tend to support the US dollar as well. So I think it's not a huge difference, but I think on balance, a Democrat victory is... he's more bullish, but I think a Trump victory is bullish as well. It's just more bullish.
Sorry, bullish. For gold or the dollar?
For gold. Yeah. So I think the US dollar would fall more under the Democrats.
But do you think, though, I guess I don't mind that as a longer term view, but do you think in the shorter term, I guess there's a...
I definitely think we're seeing the leading edge of this now. There's a whole bunch of headwinds right now for markets in general. Everything from struggles in the Congress to pass more stimulus to the Fed's balance sheet starting to unwind a little. European problems, more virus in Europe, hard Brexit and the US election. Lots of reasons for a bit of risk off over the next few months into the election and year end. And that's an environment, as John said, for a stronger USD in the short term. So I think gold's probably, the correction we've seen over the last 2 months in gold might have another leg in the very short term. And then once we get past the election and into the new wave of vaccines and what will be a slow but, sort of steady global recovery from here should be... is always a very bullish environment for gold, as the US dollar, you know, takes a pounding at the beginning of every business cycle, really.
And guys, we've also got to remember the most recent statements out of the US Fed. They are, and you know, the classic don't fight the Fed. They are allowing inflation, I mean, the new measure on inflation that they're targeting now, an average of 2%, meaning they can allow it to go above 2 for periods, given it's been below 2% for such a long time. And they reiterated that again last night. And I think it's they've got the firepower. Yes, they've been buying bonds rapidly, but they've gone nowhere near their quota. And so it's just something we all need to keep in mind, front and center.
Mm. I guess my issue, though, as well, from that perspective, is I just find that, like, you know, Australians got a target of 2-3%. We've been missing that for how many years is it now? 4 years, 5 years? I don't know.
Since Phil Lowe was appointed.
Yeah. So it's
4 years coming up to 5. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I guess, I'm sort of, yeah, I'm with you in terms of the spirit. I don't think we can generate inflation till you actually see a genuine change in terms of the magnitude of what's happening in terms of the government spending. That's my main pushback on all this, is that I think you're right, and I think the government spending is going to happen. But that's, to me, that's the big factor, is if we go back to a period of politicians who decide that, hey, maybe we've had our spend, now we just need a bit of austerity to get us to sort everything out. That's where that's where Europe obviously went wrong last time. But you can see that happen in Australia, David, don't you think?
Well, it's about to happen.
Yeah, and
in 1 week.
Yeah, I mean, if Biden gets if Biden gets up and the Republican Party keep the Senate, then maybe there's a bunch of people there who suddenly flip back and decide they are deficit hawks, and they do think that they would prefer to crash the economy under Biden and let it come back. So, yeah.
You're pushing back against inflation there, but you're not pushing back against gold.
No, that's right. And just noting as well, we've got that inflation chart up, the implied inflation, the break-even inflation. And so that's the interesting thing for me for that is, I mean, it's come back very quickly, and that we're pricing in at sort of, 1.75% inflation or something like that at the moment, over the next 10 years, which, absent a big change, I think will be tough in terms, especially as we start to see, say that China's spending bucket loads on debt, trying to pump as much stuff out to every other country as they can. You think that's going to be creating another decent deflation wave, plus a huge amount of unemployment we've got around the world. My take is that I'd probably take the under on that at the moment. Not sure what you're thinking, Dave or John.
And add to your comments, Damien, that, you know, the world's been driven by this huge tech run, and we all know that technology is what fundamentally deflationary. But the thing I look at is, there are so many competing drivers here, and the debate's out on whether we'll get inflation or not, and it may be a longer term issue. But I'm just looking at real time indicators today, and yes, some of these indicators may not be in the calculations by the feds, but just look at copper, look at oil, look at all the base metals, various commodities. We're seeing real-time inflation, and so it's really going to be interesting to see where it ends up. But all the real-time indicators I look at tell me that it's coming.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Can I ask you, John, where you see, just switching gears a bit, where you see value in gold miners, and either locally or internationally? Do you do both?
Our funds, Aussie, it's an Australian equities long short fund. We focus in resources and industrial, so I tend to focus more so on the Aussie gold space. But I do have an interest at gold miners around the globe, having previously managed a global long-short resources fund. And the beauty for us is there's still plenty of value in the Australian gold sector right across the market cap spectrum. And so, you know, whether it's, I think I touched on this last time, there's maybe 20 producers that I follow actively, and then there's, you know, and they're from small to large cap. And of course the Newcrest, Evolution, Saracen, these names are now very expensive, and they're discounting, you know, their prices are discounting much higher gold prices. But there's much better value in the mid-cap space, and there's definitely a lot of value in some of the smalls and micros, and we own a collection across that spectrum. And one name which hasn't done that well recently, unfortunately, it announced a minor downgrade at one of its producing assets, Oceana Gold. They have assets in New Zealand, the US, and the Philippines. That's currently trading on a forward, you know, calendar year 21 free cash flow multiple of just over 4x, and that's remarkable. And there are reasons why the multiple's deflated, but we think they've been overly discounted in the stock. And if the market doesn't start to reprice this stock, then a lot of these mid and large cap majors that are short growth will start to look at this as a takeover target, given its high margin ounces and long mine life. Beyond that, if you have a view, as we do, that gold price is going to be stronger for longer, you want to be positioning yourself in some of these brownfield restarts or turnaround stories, discoveries, De Grey, we've talked about before, the next call it tier one world-class assets that'll be funded and built. And I could go through, you know, we currently have 7 gold names, and you know, we're expecting every one of these names to double, if not do more so, on a, you know, 12 to 18 month view.
Just on that, actually, we've had a question drop in while we were chatting again, John. Why have Australian gold miners historically always been undervalued in the stock market? Do you agree with that, actually, before we explain it? Sorry.
yes and no. Some definitely are. And if you look at, you know, I vividly remember the last gold cycle, which started really late 2008 with QE1. And many of the small caps and even mid caps underperforming initially. And it took for North American institutions who were seeing so much value that ended up coming in and taking substantial positions in a number of stocks that then went on to do multiples. So, it's definitely happened in the past. This time around, I'm not sure that's completely right. Yes, in some stocks, but not across the board. There are some, I mean, as I said, Northern Star, Saracen, Evolution, and especially Newcrest, they are all very expensive, trading on free cash flow multiples of 16 to 25 times, depending on the stock, looking at fiscal year 21 free cash flows. And even the next year out, they still look fully valued, whereas there's a series of other names that aren't. And so it's... I don't think you can sort of put the whole basket with that comment. We have seen it in the past, but it varies.
So, John, relative to international ones, though, although you're saying, you know, the Northern Stars and Evolutions and that are expensive relative to international, though, are you seeing the same thing, or is it something you look at? Because I guess we're thinking that. You can certainly find other gold stocks globally that are more expensive than the ones.
Yeah, you can, Damien. With the bigger end of the spectrum, the key valuation tool or methodology used can vary. I mean, I've been talking about free cash flow multiples, 1 to 2 years out. Of course, the big one is price to NPV, and that can vary depending on your forward curve assumption for the gold price and what discount rate's being used. And North Americans tend to use a 5% discount rate. And I'd say that's not the discount rate that's used across the board here in Australia. And there's, we could talk for an hour about this topic, but yes, some of the North American stocks tend to trade on bigger NPV multiples using different discount rates than, say, some of the Aussie names. But at the bigger end of town, you know, particularly in Newcrest, which you'd have to start, which is definitely compared with a Newmont or a Barrick, yeah, you know, similar size market caps and reserves, you know, I'd say they're more closely aligned. But they really do differ, Damien.
Mm. Yeah, look, I guess what we've got, we've got a fair bit of gold in our portfolios, and we only run large caps. But we find the Aussie ones we can justify putting some of them in. We struggle with some of the US ones. Yeah, and again, it depends very much on what metric you want to use for it. But just as a whole, it's much more difficult to find the international ones, the large cap international ones that sort of fit our model.
Yeah, there's still a number of mid caps that are, you know, liquid, I'd say A grade management teams, maybe not, you know, 20-year mine life type world class assets, but still very good 10 to 15 year mine life with exploration upside, that I believe still have share price growth in them. You just need to do the work, rather than I mean, some people, of course, have a basket approach, but if you do the work and you're a stock picker as we are, there's definitely opportunities and the ability to, you know, pick a name like Alasa last year. Granted, the asset is in Turkey, but, you know, they were coming through a $700 million almost CapEx phase and went from spending a lot of money to harvesting and just producing free cash and unwinding the balance sheet, and that went 4 times last year. And you know, today we own another one called West African, which we think is about to do the exact same thing. And we're not limited by opportunities. We've got in fact, it's constantly a competition for capital discussion, and there's plenty of great names here in Australia that we think will do really well.
What's the state of gold hedging in the mining space these days? They gotten over it?
No, David, unfortunately, it's terrible. Just as it was this time last cycle in 2009. Look, some companies have got hedging there for the right reasons. They've they've had to raise the CapEx to build a new project and have taken the hedging out for insurance. Others, I scratch my head as to why they took out their hedging at the time. They were, I suppose, they took a view that the gold price was too high and tried to be tactical, and it's really blown up in their faces. And so sadly, if you look at the entire Australian list of producers, and we follow all of them, you know, and now if you look at our database, I can only, of the 20 plus names, I only have two names that are completely unhedged in terms of large cap, and one of them was Alasa, which I mentioned. And so yeah, there's not that many. Most of them have got, call it, 15 to almost 30% of this fiscal year hedged at embarrassing prices, so bringing down their realised prices well below the Australian dollar spot price. And to make the hedge look better, they continue to roll these hedges forward as some roll off, meaning, you know, they're taking out new hedges today at call it almost record high Australian dollar gold prices, so the average looks lower. But I think it's a kind of silly game, and us on the buy side, we can see straight through this. And particularly the names that don't need to take out that level of insurance, meaning, you know, they're going through a big spend phase, that they might already be net cash. And I won't be surprised at all, David, to see what we saw 10 years ago, where once the gold bull market really gained momentum, institutions basically forced the large caps to do capital raises to close out the hedge books, so that, you know, the companies could be completely unhedged and realizing the strength of the strong gold price move, and I won't be surprised to see some of that again. But you know, I've asked the question. Some kind of hose it down pretty quickly. I think they're too embarrassed to talk about it given the history. But
yeah, you would have thought they'd learn from last cycle.
Yeah, you'd think so.
So does it? Would that help explain some of the, I guess apocryphal undervaluation of the local gold stocks? Are the international gold miners as aggressive with their hedges?
Generally, they're not. Some of them still do have it, but generally, there's less hedging there than there is here. But the stocks that we see as most undervalued are what we'd call the small to the mid caps. They're the ones that are trading on, sometimes 60% discounts to NPV or on free cash flow multiples of 2.5 to 4.5 times. And granted, they may not be producing yet, but that's really where the big discounts are. And they'll close up as they always do with execution and delivery. And some of these names don't have any hedging. The quality of the asset is such that they've been able to, fund the development phase without, some sort of aggressive debt package carrying a hedge piece. So it really does vary.
Just another question that's dropped in. When pricing Newcrest, do you also consider their discoveries in WA and now proving Red Chris has much higher grades than many thought? I understand these projects are 3 to 4 years away from production. Thoughts on that one, John?
Yeah, I've had that question a couple of times of late. Yes, they have made some great discoveries in that you've mentioned. Of course, there's another in the Pacific, another big porphyry, Wafi-Golpu. But the problem with these big porphyries, and I suppose the best one is the Havieron discovery right next to their operation up in the northern part of WA. These discoveries, whilst they're great and can add mine life to Telfer, which is which is clearly depleting. The problem is they're, as you pointed out already, they're years away. They're 4 to 5 years away, and whilst they may not come up in a free cash flow multiple sense, they will be captured obviously in an NPV. But NPVs, as we all know, discounted cash flows. They discount once you go beyond sort of year 15. The discount rate at that point in time really does aggressively discount those cash flows, and so they're a long way away. And then the other issue, of course, is Newcrest to get to producing those big discoveries, those big porphyries. They're very capital intensive assets. You're talking multi-billion dollar investments, and Newcrest, yes, it's a big company and it's producing a lot of operating cash, but there's not a lot of free cash left when you look at the $1 billion plus CapEx phase they've got ahead of themselves for each of the next 5 years.
Very good. Thanks for that.
I wouldn't mind switching gears to some of the industrials. So I guess in terms of the industrial side, one of the things we've been speaking about is this idea that we've suspended capitalism by, and it's not just an Australian thing, it's happened in countries right around the world in terms of bankruptcies. And so bankruptcies are down, I'll call it 40% right around the globe, despite the sort of jump in unemployment. And so the issue we're looking at is, as they start to come back on again, does that start creating some issues? And I just wanted to get a feel for whether, I guess what you're seeing on the ground in terms of companies you're covering, the last reporting season was this thing about, how much of it's calm before the storm, how much of it is JobKeeper, and how much of it is genuine companies that did manage to grow throughout the coronavirus sort of downturn. Just be interested in your thoughts on that front.
Yeah, great question, Damien, and it's not that easy to answer. And I suppose the way we make it easy for ourselves is yes, we focus in industrials and resources, but when we, our industrials focus is on, it's fairly specific and in areas that we want to be invested in that are either doing well under a post-COVID world or just growth companies that are growing regardless of the economic backdrop. And so, you know, that really points to us focusing in technology, e-commerce stocks, and stocks with big growth thematics, where there's a big structural shift like the US gaming shift and what that's doing for one of our stocks, PointsBet, fintech, medtech. That's where our focus is. And these companies were doing really well prior to the COVID market collapse. And of course, as we all know now, 5-6 months on, COVID has been exceptional for their strategies and businesses. And so that's where we're focused. We've been pretty vocal on one of them, PointsBet, which has done exceptionally well. I can touch on some of these stocks, Damien, if you like.
I'm quite interested in the, it's probably more the philosophy behind, I suppose, in terms of rather than the individual names, but let's say the tech space, because that's certainly one, yeah, we've been it's been a good one for us as well, but it's getting really expensive. And so at what stage are you looking to say, you know, where do you actually start to wind back and start to say, well, no, enough's enough. Paying 100 times earnings is, you know, even if it is growing quite strongly for some of these stocks, is just too much.
We don't have any stocks that are trading on those sorts of multiples. You're right, there are plenty that are on, of course, people aren't even looking at earnings or EBITDA multiples.
No, that's right. Who cares what the multiple is? It's just in the right sector.
Yeah. So the revenue multiple and some of these stocks have gone from 3, 4, 5 times to over 20 times forward revenue multiples, and it's hard to justify that multiple on any sort of medium to, call it 3 to 5 year growth outlook. So we don't own any of those, but we're pleased that even in this market, Damien, where tech has just been so strong, we still own a handful of names that are trading on what we think are very reasonable multiples. And, you know, whether it's and yes, they've had really big price moves, but if you look at the fundamentals for the stocks, it's explained in the, you know, we've got two names, one in particular where they've just reported revenue growth of greater than 100%, and expanding operating margins. And so, if you look at Redbubble, which of course, like many tech names, got hit through the COVID smash, has really come back in a major way. There's a handful of names, or there's many e-commerce names that have done just that. And so if I look at our tech names, we own three names that are trading on less than 10 times revenue multiples. In fact, two of them are on 5 times, and we think they've got 3 to 4 year revenue growth of 20 to, in some cases, 40%. And so they'll easily grow into these multiples. And so we still see a lot of upside. There are others where, they might be early in the revenue piece, but it's been a bit of a land grab. There's been really material tie-ups with major companies in the US. If you look at the call it deregulation of the US gaming market, and, the addressable markets are, in PointsBet's case, the US market, it's a $40 billion opportunity, and it's going through massive growth. And these companies are, there's cost of customer acquisition is a key piece. But without going through all the fundamentals, Damien, we basically own a number of names that aren't trading on what we think are lofty multiples. And so we're very happy still owning them despite their runs.
Mm. And is that where you're looking now? So as you're tipping out of these ones, any of the ones that you do think are, you're hitting their limits, is that sort of where you're looking to add more, or what's your?
That's right, Damien. We're a concentrated fund, so 20 to 30 stocks on the long side, and we prefer to be more like 20. Today we're probably at the higher end, and then call it 5 to 15 on the short side. With our long book, we've got what we're really happy with, and so if anything, we're basically adding to names as opposed to adding new names, just to try and keep that concentration up. To be fair, I'll admit that if you look at our tech, medtech names, we don't have the diversity and opportunity set that the US has. We've got a much smaller sector, when you look at our technology, fintech, medtech. And so, I wish we had 20 of these names to invest in, but we're very happy with the, call it 5 to 7 that we're concentrated in.
Yeah. And you've spoken fintech in Australia. That seems to be more like debt tech, is it? I'm not sure what the right term is, but it's buy now, buy now, pay later.
Pay later.
Is that somewhere, that seems to be the heart of the bubble in the Aussie tech, is it, or are you looking elsewhere in the fintech space?
It is indeed. We're not there anymore, Damien. We were. I suppose when we payments, fintech, they get grouped together in these sorts of names, but whether it's a neobank mobile payments, we're looking across the space. But yeah, we agree the afterpays and so on, that whole sector, it just got too hot, and we're not there. We didn't exit right at the top, but equally we've happy that we've avoided the big sell-off that we've seen in recent weeks.
So within that fintech space, what are the types of companies you're looking for within that?
Well, we've got really one name right now, which unfortunately has been suspended by the ASX, and it's a company called ISX. It's a neobank, which had an exceptional run. We came into that name at their last capital raise at 13.5 cents, and they went from burning cash to break even to generating EBIT at a greater than, I think it was 26 million annualized run rate, when a lot of volatility in the stock and some questionable performance rights saw the ASX step in and suspend the stock. And unfortunately, it's been going on for a while. They've got a lot of negative press, but we like the technology. We like the markets they're serving. They're here in Australia and in Europe, and very much look forward to an outcome.
Excellent. So the other one is, do you look at any of the retail side, or I guess in terms of any of the stocks you're looking at? I guess what we're trying to get a gauge on is the states that aren't in lockdown in Australia, the states that aren't affected by the virus, say South Australia and WA, in terms of, if we're using those as a template for where some of the eastern states can get back to, it's the growth still seems to be relatively muted. And just want to sort of see whether you've got any companies, I guess, you're speaking to, and whether they're views on that in terms of the sort of the overall economic picture of Australia, trying to get a gauge on where Australia will get back to as it gradually opens up.
It's a great question, Damien, but I must admit we're not across the we're just not spending enough time to really comment effectively. Mm-hmm. If you look at our thematics and areas of focus, it's just not one for us. We with limited capital, we want to be allocating where we see the strongest tailwinds and growth rates, and that's just not up in the pecking order for us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a hard question, isn't it? I don't think anyone's got an answer. And so it's the part where you're going, well, if you don't know an answer, you may as well go to some sectors where it's safer.
Indeed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Zero back onto those gold questions, or Dave's joined.
Yeah, go for it.
Hang on. Yeah, Dave?
I'm back. Bring him on.
Sorry, but yeah, we're just the thoughts. I think Damien asked thoughts on that, the current topic.
That's right. Let's go back to the gold.
All right. Yeah, so a couple of questions here. Thanks for everyone who are posting in questions, and feel free to head over to nucleuswealth.com/webinar to pop in yours. So are there any barriers to gold becoming a Tesla for retail investors and SoftBank-like funds? So is it sort of sky the limit on gold, do you think, John?
I've had this question on, in a similar way for Bitcoin, and you saw what happened there. Of course it could happen, but I don't look forward to something like that. I don't believe it will. It's a very big market, in dollar terms. It was easier to do in in Bitcoin, given just the, you know, the orders of magnitude in terms of size difference. And you know, we've studied all the gold gold cycles that we think are relevant. And whenever gold has a real breakout, you know, those moves tend to be limited to around, I'm talking the commodity here, tend to be limited to around 40%. So if you look at the 2001 to 2006 bull market, if you look at the post GFC and even this one, you know, the moves tend to be 15 to 20% tops. And then, you know, you'll see technically in terms of the charts, you'll see some profit taking and a base formation before the next leg up. And that's kind of what we saw this year. Okay, gold's up over 30%, but it doesn't tend to move that much in a straight line. So I think there's less of a risk of that happening. And in fact, in terms of preference, I'd not like to see that. If we saw it going parabolic, then we would be selling completely into that. Mm-hmm. You know, much prefer what we're seeing of late, which is, you know, the moves are very orderly. We're not seeing big daily moves in either direction. And in fact, we think that we're poised for another move higher. But yeah, big market, I think orderly moves are the expectation.
Okay. Yep. Very good. Thanks for that. Another one here.
You can get blow-offs in gold bull markets, but John's right, they're not quite as big as the ones we've seen in Tesla and Apple and others. But those are not something that you see in any market except every 20 years or so. You get a mania.
Okay, very good. Another question here. I read recently that there was a problem with gold storage. Could a similar problem occur like what happened with oil storage 6 months ago? Guys.
Yeah, so I doubt you'll have the same issue as what you had with oil. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a heavy metal, and if you buy it, you need to think about storage. So, and not everyone wants to deal with that. And obviously high net worth banks and others, other institutions can deal with that more readily.
John, can I flip back? Because isn't it like there's something like all the gold ever mined would fit into like a couple of tennis courts?
That's right.
I think. Mm. Yeah. So like, it's not like, yeah, to me, that's not an issue because if you start running into trouble with storage, there'll be a bank somewhere that'll say, no worries.
Yeah, that's right.
I've got a vault. Let me throw all the cash out and we'll put the gold in instead.
Yeah, it's not combustible.
Exactly. And so whereas the issue with the oil is there is so much of that oil and the pipelines and the oil actually has a use. It's not just being stored. Yeah. So, you know, there's that whole part where to me that's not an issue at all in terms of the trading side of it. But actually it does raise that interesting issue is that for my part, you know, it is worth remembering for gold in terms of versus Bitcoin, your Bitcoin has value because people think it has value. If you look through the gold market, gold by and large has value because of the same reason people think it has value. Like there's a certain amount of industrial use, but and it would be a very useful industrial metal, or it is a very useful industrial metal, but you know, you pay thousands of dollars per ounce of gold. And whereas copper, you pay thousands of dollars per ton. Mm. Like it's not it's just chalk and cheese. Like you're basically taking a bet that, you know, in the large part, gold is a bet that other investors will want to buy more gold because the amount that comes from either investors or central banks just swamps the actual industrial usage of it.
That's right, Damien. There's only what 80. If you look at supply and demand, there's 80. What over 80 million? Only just it's 80 to 100 million ounces produced and consumed a year, so it's not a big market in terms of weight and size.
Yeah, and the difference between you know, you get a new iron ore mine, and you're building train lines across the country in Australia for hundreds of kilometres sometimes to ship this stuff out to port so you can actually get it to the markets that's needed. In a gold mine, they stick it in a helicopter and fly it out. Mm. Because there's literally just not that much of it.
That's right.
Or in the case of one of our clients, she flies up to Sydney and flies back with a kilo gold bar in her handbag and then buries it in her neighbour's vegetable patch. I won't say where, but anyway. no issues there.
Yeah, that's right.
Very okay. good. Well, just mindful of time. What do we have anything else to get through, Damien, or can we start the wrap-up?
No, that's it.
Happy with that? Okay, very good. Well, look, yeah, thanks again, John Deniz, for your time today. Once again, always great to have you on the show, and we've run through some terrific topics today, and I think certainly for all those gold bugs out there, and we do have a few, there's a bit for them to sink their teeth in. Do you mind just sharing with our audience how they can follow your work and get in touch with what you're doing?
Yeah, thanks, Tim. We can be found on our website, paragonfunds.com.au. If you want to get on our distribution, we update investors monthly. Just log your details and we'll be happy to include you on our distribution.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, look, yeah, thanks again for today. And we'll look forward to getting you back on the show very soon. Thanks, John. And thanks, guys.
Thanks,
very good. Coming up next week, we'll focus on the upcoming US election. Can Trump pull off another shock win and buoy markets with more of his trademark tax cuts and incongruous Twitter activity? Or will old man Biden clinch the win for the Democrats on a platform of COVID management, healthcare strengthening and environmental protection? We'll have a look at the current state of play and assess the potential impacts on both the economy and markets under each scenario. So tune in next week, Thursday, 12:30 p.m. on the 21st of September for a live chat with us. And of course, head over to nucleuswealth.com/webinar to ask questions along the way. Thanks again for all those that watched in live today for another great episode, and also to those who've asked those terrific questions. And I hope you've certainly come away with some great ideas. If you'd like to see more of our content, of course, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content to stay up to date on news from us. Follow us on social media. We always appreciate guests and topic suggestions. So if you've got one, drop them in the comments of today's YouTube video or, of course, on our Nucleus Wealth site. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend and help our show grow. So on that note, thanks very much for tuning in and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.